Okay, just to begin, first of all, hope everyone had a great afternoon so far. Of course, great morning as well, but a great afternoon. The goal of this Yom Iyun was really to try to appreciate not only the moment, but in the long term, well beyond the year or two that you spent in Eretz Yisrael, how to constantly be conscious and aware of this that we went through just now, some particular mitzvahs, and also as mitzvahs in general. I want to start with a story, a muscle is brought down. My job is to wrap this up, which means I'm not talking about chesed or tzedakah, tefillin or tzitzis, but rather the gamut of mitzvahs. The idea of why we have mitzvahs in general, how come there are so many of them. I'll start with a muscle. It's a very frightening muscle. I'm warning you in advance. It's something that when I read it the first few times, I'm still bothered by it, but I'll share my bother with you. You bother with me. The muscle brought down Chovos HaTzalmidim is about a sandler, a person who works on shoes. And he was someone who, by the side of the road, he would always help people out. People were traveling. Everyone needed help having their shoes fixed. And he made an honest living. It wasn't lucrative enough to put food on the table. However, the World War broke out and people stopped traveling. And he was only able to, do a minimal amount of jobs until eventually the well ran dry. He didn't have a job anymore. He had enough in his cupboard to last for a few days. And after those few days, he ran out of food. Now, picture he's waiting. No one's coming. No one's there. Everyone is starving. His wife, his kids, 3 days, no one has eaten. The way he describes it over here in the Sefer, is he turns and he goes to Davin. When he goes to Davin, his kids say, "Dad, don't leave us. Avi, lechem, lechem, just bread." They couldn't even speak full sentences anymore. And he says, I have to go. And his wife says to him, "Don't leave us. Al teitze mizeh. Im namus barav, we're going to die out of hunger. Kulanu yachad, we'll die together as a family. Do not leave us." And again, he shrugs off that request and he goes out to the forest. And with his last energies of strength, he starts to daven to Kadosh Baruch Hu, "You created the world. You gave us everything. I'm begging you, give us life, give me life." And he davens with all the energy he has left until he passes out from exhaustion and starvation. Basically dead. And all of a sudden, in his unconscious state, smells something. And it starts to give him like a little strength, a little chizuk. He finds himself getting energy. And he opens his eyes up and he sees a flower in a neighboring area. And he walks over and he traces the smell. And he takes a big whiff and all of a sudden he feels like fully energized. So I found a solution. We're going to survive. And he takes his flower and he starts to run home, hoping to catch his wife and kids before they pass from the world. As he's running home, all of a sudden, for the first time in months, someone comes by in a carriage. They say to him, "What are you holding in your hand, young man?" He's like, "I have to go. I'm in a rush. It's for my wife and my kids. The flower." And the guy says, "I'll buy that flower off you for gold and silver." He says, "Not gold and silver. But if you have bread, I would sell it for bread." And the guy says, "I do. I have bread." Takes out bread that will last for weeks. Food that will last for weeks for his family. And he's so excited to trade the flour for the food. And he runs home and his wife and kids are mommish in their last breath. And he's able to give them food and they're able to survive. And that night he has a dream. In his dream he sees his father. His father says to him, "I can't believe you. You blew it." "I'm talking about I blew it. I'm a hero. I saved my family. I blew it." He says, "Your tefillah rocked the heavens. Everyone, I was the hero. Being your father, I was immediately catapulted to the Hall of Fame of people in Shemayim right now. Because you brought Tchias HaMesim. You created a flower. And with that flower, they're going to grind up and everyone's going back to life again. But you sold it for bread. I am the laughingstock in Shemayim right now. I can't believe you let me down that way." And he wakes up from his dream. That's the mashal. Now, it's a troubling mashal. I don't understand. The poor guy. He did everything right. He did everything right. He davened. He had a moon in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He did such a great job. He actually brought Tzkias HaMeitzim, unbeknownst to him. He sold a flower. Okay, it was an accident. But it's hard to fault him. Okay, maybe he made a bad choice, but you can't say to the guy, what were you thinking? He was thinking about his wife and kids. He didn't know what he had in his hands. It's hard to fault him, but it's not so hard to fault us sometimes. We don't have to guess what to do in our lives. I'm not trying to figure out, gosh, I wonder what's expected of me right now. We have a cheat sheet. It's so easy. I use this a lot of times to my Talmidim. Imagine before the SATs and someone gave you a cheat sheet. C, B, D, C, 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 B, D, A. And you're up there. You know what the answers are, but you're like, come on. Too many C's in a row. Doesn't look right. I know it's right, but come on, I can't do that. So you erase it, you put an A in. There aren't too many A's out there. So you got a question wrong. Why'd you do that? Because that'd be a silly thing to do, obviously. But in reality, is that not what we do? Every time we have a mitzvah opportunity to come your way and you pass, you have a cheat sheet for this world. It should be super easy. Everything you want to know, it's already there. You just got to follow the script. But we have a hard time doing it. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who passed away recently, I talked about him a few months ago, he points out that the very first four stories in the Torah are full of letdowns. Adam and Chava, that's how it starts. First big story. Letdown, they ate from the tree. I don't want to spoil the ending for you, but they ate from the tree. Second story is Cain and Hevel. Letdown. The guy killed his brother. Bad. Third story. We fast forward basically into the story of Noach. Letdown. The entire world is perverse. And only he survives. And even he who survived didn't bother recruiting anyone to join him except for his immediate family and some animals. And finally, the last story we have, the last narrative, the last discussion of people getting together in Parshas Noach is Migdal Babel, the Tower of Babel. Once again, a terrible letdown. People working together who are Baruch Hashem, who are getting along very nicely, and instead of using their powers to do something productive, they try to storm the heavens, literally. Letdown. All four of them. Where Sachs points out there are four letdowns of different styles. Four irresponsibilities. Adam and Chava, after they made their mistake, the biggest letdown was they were called out. And they each denied personal responsibility. It's the girl's fault. You gave her to me. It's her fault. She encouraged me. And she in turn says it's the snake's fault. No one accepted personal responsibility. That was flaw number one, story number one. There were victims. The blame game. By the way, victims is exactly what we have nowadays. People who have it, not great, they're victims. It's everyone else's fault. It's not my fault. It's everyone else's fault. When there's crime in the country, it's because they weren't given opportunities. It's everyone else's fault. It's not my fault. Look around the news. Every person who struggles in life, it's someone else's fault, not my fault. That's how the world started. That's what we're used to. That's our tradition. Cain and Hevel, famous words. Hashomer achi anochi. Am I my brother's keeper? Meaning, I know I did something that you don't approve of. So what? I don't care. It was a moral irresponsibility. I don't have to worry about my brother. Am I his keeper? I worry about me. It's like Darwinism, survival of the fittest, and I happen to be the fittest today. So I survived. Moral irresponsibility. Story number two. Story number three is communal irresponsibility. Forget everyone else who was doing bad things. Noach at least was a tzaddik, Bedoro Sub, we are told. And yet, he did nothing to encourage anyone around him to join his plight. It's true, he was building in public, and people would ask, and he would tell them. But that's where it stopped. There was no communal responsibility that he shared. And for that, the entire world goes through a factory reset. As if creation began again. The waters filled the world until eventually creation was redone. And when we come out again, starting instead of Adam and Chava, it was Noach and his family. And then finally, Migdal Bavel, it's called ontological irresponsibility, which means a challenge to God. Do not believe in God's methods. I reject. I'll storm the heavens to take over. I don't like how it's being done up till now. Four irresponsibilities: personal, moral, communal, ontological, about God. Those are the four responsibilities that took place in the first four stories in Bereishis. But then we have a fifth story. And everything changes. And that is, next story we have, anyone know? Avram. Avram Avinu changes the world. He's actually called an Ivri, because Ivri means on the other side. He stood alone. The rest of the world was still stuck in all those areas I described, and Avram stood alone. And his entire life he spent changing irresponsibility to responsibility. Let's give you some examples. Lech Lecha. Go for yourself. Personal responsibility. The buck stops by you. You got to go and for yourself. Take care of it. He saved Lot. Even though Lot and him had a little bit of a falling out, he saved Lot from being kidnapped from kings who were much greater than he was. We're told he and 318 people, maybe even only referring to as Eved, went and took down an entire bunch of kings and their armies. He felt a moral responsibility to protect his brother, his nephew, brother-in-law. Communal responsibility. Where do you see that? Where do you see that from Avraham Avinu? We're told he traveled with Nefesh, Asher, Asu B'charan. He converted. He was the first Kiruv Ori edition. He and his wife. They went around town. They converted people. People joined them in their journey. Communal responsibility. It's not about me only. I got to bring people for the ride. And finally, to accept God's hand in the world. He smashed the Avodah Zarah. Akedas Yitzchak. Doesn't get more than that. He accepted HaKadosh Baruch Hu's reign in the world, willing to slaughter the son he'd been waiting for 100 years to have. And he was ready to slaughter him because God runs the world. Everything that happened up till now was fixed. Through responsibility, I saw a great line by Rabbi Sachs. It means responsibility. I know I said the same thing, just slower. But I don't mean to. It's two words. Responsibility. You have the ability to respond when you have responsibility. What does that mean? If I'm responsible, then I can actually have a comment and respond to you. You got a tine on me? If I'm responsible, I have to listen. And then I have the ability to respond. Either to say, you know what? That's on me. That's my bad. I tell my kids all the time, a lie. That's on me. That's my mistake. That's the ability to respond when you have responsibility. In the Gemara Pesachim, it brings down that the word responsibility in Hebrew is achrayus. Achrayus means when I recognize as an acher. There's something else besides myself. That's why I have responsibility. It's not about me. The world is much bigger than only me. It's also me and also not me. And our acher that we have is God. That's our acher. When it comes to Baruch Hu, I recognize an other than myself. When there's a God in the world, then in fact, that trumps everything else around me. That's my responsibility. I'm able to respond when I have a world where I see a Kadosh Baruch Hu in it. And how do I respond? By following him. That's what Torah is, that's what mitzvahs are. Now, the reason why it's so special to have a mitzvah opportunity is because how do you define, you know, how does someone know he's doing something that's worthwhile? How do I have self-worth? Well, I'd have to look at someone and see how they value me. So how does culture value me? How does my profession value me? But those aren't really great ways to know how valuable you actually are, because that requires me to appreciate the value system of the one who I'm looking to please. Like if you go to the workplace, so how does someone value me? Whatever they value, I try to provide. But are their values really good values? The muscle. I'll give you an example. If I would take today's values and rewind backwards 25 years, the heroes of today would be the criminals 25 years ago. And vice versa. 25 years ago, people that would have been applauded and appreciated for their perspective on the world today would be considered public enemy number one for their viewpoints. That means that I'm trying to win value and worth by someone who might change in 20 years from now. The tweets that I would send out if I had Twitter, which I don't, today could make me a hero and 20 years from now make me fired from my job. There are so many stories like this. Athletes. You know, someone dug. They dug deep and they found when they were 17 years old, they made an inappropriate slight. It's not appropriate. But now they're fired for it. They lose their job. Because 17 years earlier, they made a one-liner as a high school kid. Inappropriate. Who are we trying to win value in front of? Who am I trying to get worth from? Who do I want to make sure that I feel like I'm doing a good job in their eyes? Something that in 20 years from now I'd be embarrassed that I did? And embarrassed that I worked for that person? I hope not. Well, what's left? There's one timeless, eternal perspective in the world. It's the Torah. It's eternal and it's timeless. And if you figure out how to follow and win value in that world, then that's an eternal value. Timeless. And again, as I mentioned earlier on, and we have the cheat sheet. It's called Torah and Mitzvahs. You do mitzvahs, that means you earn value and worth in the eyes of the one who determines what true value and worth really is. Not based on how culture is looking at things today or tomorrow, but based on from the beginning of creation until today. You know how lucky you are, I am, we are, that we're told what makes us valuable in the world? Maybe not in everyone's eyes. It's okay. It's okay. I'd rather invest in the one who's eternal than the one who's here today and gone tomorrow. Mitzvahs have so much detail. You guys learned about a few mitzvahs today. There's so much detail in mitzvahs. Right? We talked about tefillin before. It's just how many strings you have wrapped a certain way, or it's filling what's in the boxes and the shape of the boxes and black and how many times you wrap around your hands. There's so many details to mitzvahs. It can get somewhat claustrophobic and frustrating. There's even details in mitzvahs, I won't say Norman Huggin will call it, or Hanhuggos, behavior of how you take a shower, how you go to the bathroom, how you wipe yourself. There's like suggestions. Well, you shouldn't use that finger. After all, you got your tefillin around that hand. At some point, wouldn't you like to say, like, you know what? A little space would be nice. Let me choose how to shower. Let me choose how to relieve myself. Or you realize the following unbelievable idea. The more valuable something is, the more rules and ideas you'll have associated with it. I'll give you an example of that. I'll give you an example. You have anyone here, I mean, I hope you haven't yet, maybe some of you have, of course. We bought our wives wedding rings. So you go to a diamond dealer. You go to a diamond dealer, and they take what's called a loop. A loop is like a thing they put by your eye, and they kind of start analyzing it, looking at it, you know, with the color and the clarity. And they're look, any sort of a problem, a flaw that will change its value, around it matters so much because it's super, super valuable. Anything else is not so valuable. They just look at it, wait, and send it out, send it on your way. The more valuable something is, the more the details actually matter a lot. So when you go and you see a mitzvah, and there's like so many criteria and deals, you know what that means? This must be super special. They're using a loop right now to decide exactly the rules behind that mitzvah. Super special. So when you hear about tzitzis, is it made that way or this way? Was it spun together with shame mitzvah tzitzis? My tefillin, is it black? Is it by accident the wrong way when I put it on my arm? It flipped over. My yotze anymore? You think, well, I'm trying. What's the difference? I'm trying anyways. No. Imagine you buy you know, your wife a wedding ring, or so you thought it was diamond, but it was cubic zirconium. It was fake. She's like, what, you bought this? Like, I tried. I don't know. It looked nice, like the other one. That doesn't work that way. You know why? Because this is a precious material. And precious materials have to be treated preciously. And you might feel very restricted and tight and stuck. But the most beautiful music comes when there's real tightness. If anyone here, I don't play guitar at all. Anyone play guitar? Guitar players among us? Menachem? Nate? Okay. Who? Someone does. Someone plays guitar. So, yeah, I assume, based upon my limited knowledge, that the guitar strings are not tight. It doesn't play well. You strum it, and it like kind of like doesn't have the tightness to create the beautiful sound. When you have a mitzvah that's tight, means there are rules. It's pulled. It's keep it like this way. It creates the most beautiful sound when things are loose. Yeah, this works. That works. Anything works. There is no sound to that. It doesn't make the noise it's supposed to make. Because in life, sometimes the stress and the tension is what creates the most beautiful sound when you play it well. A mitzvah is tight sometimes. Yeah, I feel tight. But when you play that guitar with tight strings, it makes the most beautiful sound. If you took something that's a little looser, you loosen all the things, I'd chill out a little bit. Just lose everything looser. You're going to play it. It's not going to make a sound. That's not what you want. You don't want your life to not make a sound like that. Mitzvahs, for so many of us, began this year as being obligations. But we have the chance to turn those obligations into what's called opportunities. If you look at a mitzvah as a chance to, again, my cheat sheet of life. Life hack. I know what to do right now. I know how I'm supposed to handle this right now. That's the ultimate goal. Not only in each individual mitzvah, but in life in general. I'll just end off with the last small point. I want to tell you what life without mitzvahs is like. Now, many of us live that way, actually, for part of our lives. I don't mean no mitzvahs, but I mean like haphazard. It wasn't a major part of our life. In Tehillim, in Kuf Lamed Vav, in Pasuk Chavav, which we know from davening on Shabbos, Hod Hashem Ki Tov Ki Lulam Chasto, there are 26 verses that say on the Ki Lulam Chasto, 26. And Rashi points out, you know why I said 26 times Ki Lulam Chasto? Because it took 26 generations until we received the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu was generation number 26, and he got the Torah his time. And until that point in time, it was mamish a chesed that we were alive in the world. Because the world without Torah mitzvahs, there's no reason for it. There's no reason. As we saw already in our story we mentioned in the beginning, without having morality, personal, communal, believing in Kadosh Baruch Hu in the world, it's not going to last. So for 26 generations, Hashem did the biggest chesed for us. He let us be here. Until eventually, we received the Torah. People kept the Torah before it was given, actually. We told the Avos kept the Torah before it was given. But that didn't count fully. You know why? Because they did it by choice. There's a phrase, Gadol ha-mitzuv v'oseh, Yemishein ha-mitzuv v'oseh. Greater is the one who's commanded than the one who's not commanded. The reason why is because the one who's not commanded, it's easy. It's easy to keep the laws when there's no commandment. I can. It's extra credit. Yes, no, whatever. Back to, it's not tight. You don't feel like you're on edge. So it's not a big deal. I'll give you a muscle for that. It's a great muscle I heard quoted one time by my student many, many years ago. It was a Rosh Shiva who was giving shiur in his closed Talmud test him one day. I can't make it to shiur on Sunday because I have a big soccer game. And I'm like a star striker. Is that what's called a striker? Or it's called even? Star forward offensive man and striker. Thank you. Football. I'm talking about football. I don't want to say yes. Say soccer. Football. And I gotta go. I gotta score some goals. I gotta win the game for my team. The rabbi says, "Oh, you're a good player. I didn't realize that. You know what? I have a better idea. I can get you to score goals and win the game for your team. Friday before Shabbos, I'm gonna stand in the goal. You kick it, and you'll score. We'll cheer together, and you'll be the hero. Then we can learn cheer on Sunday. You don't have to go to the game on Sunday." We can learn shiur instead. He says, "Come on, like, Rabbi, it's so nice of you, but I have to have someone who's trying to stop me." So, you know, I'm crazy. I'll pretend to try to stop you. I'll even try. You're much better than I mean. I'll try. I'll dive. You'll kick it past me. We'll celebrate together. You're the hero. We'll have shiur on Sunday together. He said, no, Rabbi, it doesn't work that way. I need to do it and score when it's really, really tough. And I succeeded anyways. And he said to him, "You're right. It's exactly right. You need to do it when it's really, really tough. And that's why you succeed." When you have a challenge, it's called the Yetzer Hara, and he wants you to fail, that means that if you pass that test, you're the hero. You get everyone put it on your shoulders and you get it right off in the sunset because you succeeded when it was really, really tough. Until we received the Torah, it wasn't so tough. Take it or leave it. You want to do extra mitzvah? Kol hakavod. Your choice, extra credit. It wasn't mitzvah, osa even. The Torah is given, that makes our life so much harder, which makes our result that much more important. The nations of the world thought of Matan Torah. The world is about to be destroyed again. They went to Bilam HaRasha, the Medrash says. And they said to him, what's going on? What's happening? I see the world shaking again. Is the world about to be destroyed again? He said, no. What happened is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took out the Torah from his secret hiding place for the last X amount of generations. And he's presenting it to the world for the first time. Factory reset number 2. But this time, it reset to the way the world was supposed to be. Chazal tells that everyone who was sick was healed. The world was recreated at that moment in time. Because when you have a mitzvah in your life, you're a different person. Everything is better. And more than that, up till this point in time, only a handful of people were able to actually succeed in mitzvahs. The Avos, the Shvatim, a handful of people. But everyone else was like running around, not knowing what to do with themselves. And now everyone gets to be elite. There's no special individual. We're all special. Every person has a chance to do a mitzvah. The problem is, we don't always do our part. So here we are on the receiving end of this beautiful Torah. Here we are given the gift of all gifts. And yet, how many of us can say confidently that we live our lives doing the right thing all the time? When we want it, we do it. I'm going to give you another mashal, one of my favorites. It's found in the Sefer Pesach, Kron wrote, I forget which one it was, but one of the Maggid stories. I say this almost every year. There was a small town that was trying to raise enough money to have a Sefer Torah, and it took them many, many years. They were a very small town. They were a very poor town. But after about 15 years of collecting and collecting, they raised enough money to buy their first and their only Sefer Torah. And when they finally were able to afford it, they made a big celebration, and they told all the people interested in town, make a parochas, the Sefer Torah covering. Whoever makes the nicest parochas, the best one, has the schus of having it on the Sefer Torah when we dance it to the Aron Kodesh for the very first time. And all these people got together, and they started to sew and to stitch and to weave. And sure enough, one older lady, about 65 years old, won the contest. Her beautiful crimson paroches for the Sefer Torah was chosen as the one that would be dancing with the Sefer Torah to the Aron for the first time. And as the lady of honor, she invited all of her children and grandchildren to come from neighboring towns and villages. They should celebrate with her as her paroches was chosen to accompany Sefer Torah. Sure enough, they comes. She's dressed in her finest Shabbos gear. And they put Sefer Torah down to put the parochas on it. And humiliatingly, it didn't fit. They never tried it on. And it was too small. And she's watching in horror. They maneuver this way, pull over that arm of the Torah, and it just won't go. And they look at her and they say, this is very embarrassing for all of us. We got to pick the second runner-up. This isn't going to fit. I feel so terrible. We should have checked. I lie. My bad. And she's heartbroken. As they're about to put the next one on, and she says, no, wait, I have an idea. Just cut some of the pages off. It'll fit. Just make it fitter. Stick it on. We can still put it in. That was the mashal he brought. So often in life, it doesn't work with me. This mitzvah, I don't like that mitzvah. It doesn't fit with my personality. So you know what I'm going to do? I either change my personality or I change the Torah. It doesn't fit. Cut those pages off. I don't need that mitzvah. So God gave us the most beautiful, perfect thing, but we're not ready sometimes to get it. And that's the hardest part. Mitzvahs give us a chance to be great for 2 reasons. Number 1, I mentioned earlier, gives us an anchor in a crazy world. We're able to understand what's right and what's not right. And number two, maybe even more importantly, Sefer Chinuch brings down that mitzvahs train your body. They train you. If you live a life of constantly thinking about doing this right, doing that right, then your body eventually becomes naturally attached to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Achrei ha'pulos nimshachin ha'levavos. After your actions, how your heart eventually feels as well. It's an opportunity that you have to change yourself around by constantly doing positive things until you turn to a naturally positive person. We know there's 248 positive commandments, 248 limbs of our body. Every mitzvah of the Torah is like a limb. Your limbs turn into walking Torah pieces when you follow the Torah completely. And God wants nothing more than that. We spoke today about a number of mitzvahs that you went through. The whole idea, the whole concept of it in the first place is personal responsibility. You can do it. Move over here to chesed. I have a moral obligation to help those less capable than me. Stucca, communal responsibilities. Kashrus, Hashem's in charge. Every detail of our lives of bettering what happened at the beginning of creation of the world, the beginning of the Torah, we worked out a little bit of them today. We work on them all the time in our lives. If you believed, whether you understand every mitzvah or not, the mitzvah comes because of Baruch Hu, then you would feel like, you know what, I'm so lucky to do this, whether I get it or not. I'll tell you one last story, and then we'll stop. I saw this story in the Sefer of Moshe Shmuel Shapira, in the Sefer called Zav Mishpa, on the Parsha. He says there was one time, there was this big, as we all know, there are certain, I don't know if your shuls have bidding for different kibbudim on different holidays. But in Yom Kippur, the kibbud of Ne'ilah is super, super expensive. You're the zocher to open up the Aron for Ne'ilah. It's a big skula. People say it maybe brings wealth with it. It's a lot of opportunity. And sure enough, as with every year, it was a very big bidding war for Ne'ilah. And the same person usually won every year, Baron Rothschild, is the one who always won it. That's why he's very well-to-do, I'm sure, as well. Take money to get money. And as always, he bid up Ne'ilah. Well, these dollars that are rubles, you know, it was a different currency, but, you know, $1,000. And you have a few people who are bidding with him. So he gets to $10,000, and everyone backs out. And all of a sudden, one guy in the back says, $20,000. Hush falls over the crowd. This guy, you know, playing with the big boys. Never seen him before him. Rothschild said, $25,000. He says, $50,000. Shocking. Never has it gotten his eye. Rothschild says, $65,000. And all of a sudden, the guy stands at the table, bangs his hand and says, $100,000. Like, it's it. Like, dumbfounded. And he's like, I'm out. Take it. And sure enough, going once, going twice, going third time to the guy in the front row, or the back row, I think I said beforehand. $100,000 for the schuss of opening the Aron for Ne'ilah. Sorry, for Ne'ilah. The guy next to him said, wow, kol kavod. So impressed. He says, thank you so much. But can I ask you a quick question? He asked the guy next to him, the guy who just bid for it, asked the guy next to him, can I ask you a question? He says, anything. He says, what's Ne'ilah? 1 second. He bid $100,000. You don't know what he bid for even? No idea what he bid for. He says, why'd you do it? He goes, I know one thing. That Rothschild guy, he really seems to know a good deal when he sees one. And he was bidding high. I want a piece of that also. That's why I bid for it. I'll tell you something very important. Kadosh Baruch Hu, he knows a really good deal when he sees one. And he's bidding on you. And he gave you the currency is mitzvahs. I don't care what mitzvah, I don't care how close you connect to it or not. You're sitting on a gold mine. Not just this year. And not just next year. You have a life hack in front of you. You got the cheat sheet. You may get it, you don't get it, but one thing you should get is if you had to pick a partner to join this world with, God is a great partner to have. His value system never changes. Timeless. There's nothing else in the world we could possibly say that about. Nothing. So you want a straight ticket to success, then you should major in mitzvahs. Every one that you can. It's hard. But it's super worthwhile. I give you a bracha. You should be zoch not only today, not only tomorrow, not only this year or next year, but in life, whether you get it or you don't get it. I appreciate it or don't appreciate it. It doesn't matter. I'm fortunate to tap into the beauty, to the gift, to the life that God gave us. Have a great rest of your day.